to occupied Western Sahara, then make our way to the airport.
All right.
Now we'll leave in the hotel.
At the gate, we pass through a final gauntlet of Moroccan Mukhabarat, or intelligence agents. As we head to the plane, one of them says, "I hope you had a good time in Moroccan Sahara." Moroccan Sahara, the term the Moroccan government uses, but no country in the world officially recognizes. Morocco occupies Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. For Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman, with John Hamilton, Mike Burke, and Dennis Moynihan. This has been a Democracy Now! Special. In December, the United Nations will host talks in Geneva between Morocco and the Sahrawi liberation movement known as the Polisario Front, along with Algeria and Mauritania. They'll be the first such talks since 2012. 4 days in Western Sahara, Africa's last colony, was directed by John Hamilton and produced with our news director, Mike Burke, and Dennis Moynihan. Special thanks to Maria Carrion, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Brendan Allen, Hugh Grand, and all those who helped us along the way. All music by the late Sahrawi singer, Mariam Hassan.
KABU Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KABU. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kabu.org or send to KABU Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, "Why is KABU important?" Deadline to apply is Sunday, November 25th at midnight. More information on the development director position is available at kabu.fm/developmenthire2018.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor live performances by Tony Furtado on Friday and Saturday, November 23rd and 24th at 8 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Tony Furtado is a Portland songwriter in the Americana bluegrass realm. This is his 8th annual Thanksgiving Bash at Mississippi Studios. On November 23rd, he's playing a seated acoustic show with guest collaborator Scott Law, with Jack Straw opening. On November 24th, he'll be playing an electric set with guest collaborator Stephanie Schneiderman. Richie S. Young opens the show. Again, that's live performances by Tony Furtado on Friday and Saturday, November 23rd and 24th at 8 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:02. Coming up next is The Spin. KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Portland 5 Centers for the Arts, presenting Dorota Schmidt and the Django Festival All-Stars, November 27th at the Newmark Theater. More information online at portland5.com. It's time for The Spin.
I'm Esther Amar. Welcome. You're listening to The Spin. It is that time for an hour where smart is sexy. The Spin, our weekly all women of color media panel. I'm coming to you live from Star FM studios in Accra, Ghana. Our contributors are on the line via NPR, Washington, D.C. We are on air nationally, across the United States and internationally. In Ghana, this program is brought to you by the African American Public Radio Consortium. Today on The Spin, we continue the Consent Convo, a public conversation campaign on consent. We talk the personal, the societal, the cultural, and the educational. We ask, what did we learn about consent? What do we need to unlearn? how do we create a consent-positive environment in our educational institutions? The Consent Convo is brought to you by The Spin and Emotional Justice in partnership with Essence. Check out Essence every Thursday, and they'll post each show plus a piece on the Convo contributors. Consent, sharing, unlearning, reframing, reimagining. All of that coming up. Our contributors this week are two educators, Dr. Nadia Lopez and Frenchie Davis. Dr. Nadia Lopez is the founding principal of Mott Hall Bridges Academy, a Brooklyn, New York-based middle school. Dr. Lopez pioneers a leadership path showing underprivileged communities and creating positive institutions that have global impact. Due to Dr. Lopez's work in education, she has appeared on The Ellen Show, visited President Obama, and received the Medal of Distinction from Barnard College. In 2015, a Honi fundraiser raised $1.4 million to provide Nadia students with college trips and scholarships. Dr. Lopez is also a Black Girls Rock change agent, a TED Fellow, and author of The Bridge to Brilliance, an inspirational account of the creation of a path-breaking inner-city middle school in Brooklyn, New York. Frenchie Davis is an educator on human sexuality with a focus on the African-American community. Frenchie combines her expertise of social services, education, and pop culture to entertain, educate, and enhance the emotional and sexological intelligence of her audiences. Frenchie collaborates with several organizations from DC Public Schools, Metro Teen AIDS, the National Council for Black Studies, the College of Black Studies at the College of Charleston, and in 2015 was a research scholar at the Cuba Delegation for Race, Culture, Gender, and Sexuality. Frenchie is host of the radio show Libido Talk on New York's WBAI. Welcome, welcome, ladies.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hello.
Let's start with your personal journeys on consent. How did you learn about consent? Who taught you? How did what they taught you shape your relationship to your body, to sex, to power, to men, to women? Did the actual word ever come up for you? And if so, in what context? How did family and especially culture influence that teaching for you? And how did society shape your ideas of what it meant to be a woman and notions of consent? What kind of sex education was there at school, if any? And how did religion shape your learning about consent and sex? So let's talk consent and your personal journeys in understanding what it was. Frenchie Davis, let me start with you, your thoughts.
One, I have to say that and acknowledge that I am a victor. I am a survivor of sexual assault from a young girl and growing up through my teenage and adolescent years. But I also believe that consent for me and understanding it was very fractional in my life. And from my childhood through my teenage years, through my early adulthood, and now as what I call grown, consent is very, very different for me. So I consider consent in my journey very fractional. And I imagine that as people evolve and learn to understand themselves, that it may be very fractional for them as well.
Break down what you mean by fractional. Exactly what was it for you in your childhood? How did it change? And what did it change into in your teens?
As a child, and I think that many children are this way, that I don't think that consent usually exists for children. We say things like, eat your vegetables, clean your plate. We don't get to say, as children sometimes, yes or no, or kiss this relative, go give them a hug, even though we may not want to as children. And I think now today we are learning that, you know, if a child doesn't want to hug or give a kiss to Aunt so-and-so or Uncle Bob, that we don't pressure them to do so. Whereas when we see our children start to develop and we start pointing out their development, oh, look at her, you know, she's finally, her breasts are finally coming in around the family members. To me, I think it's kind of traumatizing to start discussing my body around the family. And that's the first place where I think that young people learn that they don't have the right to say no, and they lose their sexual agency very early. And so when I work with parents today, I remind them that they are entitled to their sexual privacy even as children, and that we need to be mindful of some of the things that we do, maybe out of tradition or out of mockery.
I want to really hold the space. So our first conversation is all about our personal journeys to consent, and then the second half will be about your work. But the first one is really about, I want to really hear about you, because this is where you connect with millions of people who then think about their personal journey. So I want to hold the space and really have you talk about your personal journey to begin with.
It was very diverse. My father was a womanizer, and my mother was a very conservative woman. And I was a crossbreed of these parental experiences. And I learned repression through my mother, and I learned sexual adventure through my father. And I knew it was something unique and different about it when I double dated with my father. And I had probably certain freedoms of expression that I think that was very unique. I was very keen on that in my early teenage years. And because of that, ironically enough, I ended up being more restrictive. I did not give consent around my body until I was in college. I had never even dated a guy whose parents were divorced, probably until I was 25. So I had this image of what men were going to be like to me because of my experiences with my father, because of watching him with other women. And there was a lot of sexism, a lot of womanizing. And I knew that that was not going to be the path that I walked, even though I watched it as it was normalized for me to see. And because it was normalized, I think it was interesting as a survivor that in a lot of ways I was able to move past those experiences because it was kind of normalized. And it wasn't until I was in my graduate studies for human sexuality and I interviewed a pedophile that I came to my own fruition about my experience and how unnormal it was. And then from that point on, consent again, speaking fractionally, became something very new for me.
Do you remember what age you first learned about it, when you say it was fractional, and then at what point it changed in terms of your adolescent years?
I was sexually abused very early on. I was probably 5 in the first instance. The following instance, I was around 12 or 13. The other instances to follow, unfortunately, were in my teenage years by the person that my mother was married to at that time. Ironically, he would do things like kiss me over my mouth, and I would resist. And he would say, "See, I'm teaching you, you know, if a boy does this to you, you don't let him do that." And again, because I had normalized womanizing, I did not understand the barriers that he was crossing at that time. I knew it didn't feel comfortable, but I did not understand the barriers because womanizing was a normalcy in my experiences watching my biological father and being a child. So I had normalized these type of unfortunate experiences. And then in my adulthood, learning more about my sexual agency, learning more about who I was as a sexual being, I could reconfigure consent in a way that continues to allow me to heal. So there was a lot of decolonizing for me sexually to continue to allow me to heal. And also, luckily, I've been surrounded by healthy men who nurtured that healing process for me.
Dr. Nadia Lopez, your thoughts?
Just like Frenchie, I had experienced sexual abuse by a family member, but one of the things when listening to Frenchie that came up for me is how we're taught consent. So my mom made it very clear about what consent was and how you should protect yourself, protect your body. But when she shared this with me, and even my father shared this with me, they would always talk about be wary of other people that are not part of your family. So the adults that you may come in contact with, whether it's at school, whether it's in the neighborhood, but they really didn't take time to really discuss, be mindful of family members and even family members who are children themselves and don't know what that may mean in terms of seeking consent from a child who doesn't even understand what they're being asked to do. And so that probably happened like when I was 9 years old, eight or nine years old. By the time I became an adolescent, going through my teenage years, even going into my 20s, I grappled with this idea of love and consent. So it was tied around a lot of the self-esteem and self-worth and what that meant in terms of giving someone else that consent. So I didn't find myself wanting to be in relationships because I had a fear that someone would violate or take that consent from me, especially as I was grappling with my dad being separated from my mom and just having to go through a whole host of things mentally. And so I ended up in a relationship with someone, getting married to that person, and realizing that I had given consent to someone who didn't even value the consent that they had been given, access to me as an individual, full mind and body. And so it really didn't click until I had my own daughter about what that would mean in terms of teaching her the true meaning of consent, teaching her whether it's how someone engages with you physically, how someone engages with you mentally, how someone engages with you spiritually, how your self-worth is determined on what you're willing to accept from others, and how you have to be strong in your convictions, even as a child, just knowing what's right and what's wrong, and understanding that every adult and every child, even if they're their family members or not, do not have the right to violate you in any way, shape, or form. And so by my experience, I had to have early conversations with my daughter, probably from the time that she was 3, in a way that she would understand, 4, 5, 6, and even now that she's 15, always checking in with her, being very conscious of who she surrounds herself with. And then, you know, being mindful of what are the images that she's seeing online or on television, because I think a lot of our children are what they're exposed also influences what they believe to be consent, and how, you know, even in this unfortunate situation with the presidential election where things may be said and where people say that that's a certain type of locker room talk, where our kids start to become programmed that if someone in any way, shape, or form violates you in a way that it wasn't consensual for you to speak to me that way, it wasn't consensual for you to touch me that way, that that's not okay. That we can't just chalk it up to this is boys will be boys or girls will be girls. That's not correct. People have a right to their personal space and how they should be treated in this world.
One of the things that's really powerful about this is the idea of being robbed of saying no. And so because so much of the way we think about consent is kind of a no means no framing, it makes me wonder about two things for you both. How have you had to unlearn your body being a site where permission was taken away? And that part of what we've been talking about in the consent convo is creating what I call a consent positive environment. And so a space where we actually see power in permission and see power and pleasure in permission as opposed to the opposite. And that we think of consent in a very no means no space. I wonder for you both being survivors, how was your yes shaped by your experience and what informs when you say yes as a result of what you've both survived? Starting with you, Frenchie.
Because I take such pleasure in saying yes, it's a happy word. So because yes is pleasure for me in any instance, whether I'm doing something for a friend and I say yes, I take pleasure in it. So I've learned for myself to never do anything that I don't take pleasure in, because then I am fulfilled and rewarded in every circumstance. Simply, if I don't want to do it, if someone says, will you do something for me, and I really don't want to do it, because I remember not having the ability to say no or yes and have that option, I wholeheartedly say no because I know I won't enjoy it. So for me, in giving, in loving, in doing favors, in working in my job, in any instance, if it is not pleasurable, I don't say yes.
And you, Nadia?
It goes along those lines that it's about, are the decisions when I'm saying yes in honor of who I am? Is it compromising my beliefs? Is it putting me in harm's way? When I wake up tomorrow, will I be okay with the decision that I made? And that's sometimes hard for a lot of people to admit to, because oftentimes the reason why we say the yes is because we don't want others to judge us or think less of us. So we give a lot of consent, even child to parent. We give consent to our parents, even though it's some things that we don't want to do, we do it, right? And then we get into relationships, whether it's personal or business, and we give consent because we don't want this person to think less of us. But at the end of the day, the question becomes, would we be okay doing the same thing to that person? And how do we create those boundaries that says to every individual that if this is not okay for me, then I'm not going to be in agreement with it. And it has nothing to do with you, but it really has to do with me being able to own this decision and understanding what consequences come with it after.
Self-care has to be a priority.
What have you had to unlearn in order to create healthier, more loving engagements between yourself and your body and whoever you choose to bring in contact with your body? What have you had to unlearn? Starting with you, Frenchie.
Just about everything, quite honestly. And that's why I say, you know, decolonizing my mind, decolonizing. I've had to unlearn, you know, how many sexual partners I should have. I've had to unlearn what is appropriate dress or inappropriate dress. I've had to unlearn my so-called place as a woman. I've had to unlearn that, you know, you're nobody until somebody loves you. I've had to unlearn that women are inferior or that girls are inferior. I've had to unlearn the power that we give men. I've had to unlearn all of those things, and that's just some of them. I've had to unlearn, like, if somebody wants you to smile because, oh, you know, you should just smile, even if I don't feel like smiling. Or I've had to unlearn that women are emotional creatures. No, like everybody has feelings. Or that if I want to get rid of a guy that's approaching me, then I should just tell him that I have some fictitious boyfriend because he will heed me saying that there's a man present instead of just heeding my personal no. And I don't have to give you a reason for that no. So I've had to unlearn all of that.
The biggest thing for me was understanding, unlearning what society has placed on us in terms of our gender and roles. The whole idea that my value is only tied to the fact that I could be successful, but if, you know, you're not married, then you're not successful. Or this idea that somehow we are property and that our minds, especially as Black women, that it's not valued and we should be seen and not heard. And that was a process that I had to go through because I did get married and I felt like, again, I gave consent to someone else being in my life and not honoring who I was as an individual. And so it was no longer about what everybody else thought. It wasn't about, are people going to judge me because I'm admitting to this marriage having failed to individuals who have a child together. But it was about, I need to be able to live. I need to be free. I need to give my own personal self the consent to say that it's okay and that we can rebuild and we can create a life as a single parent and continue to have a career and learn from every mistake that was made. And so the unlearn was learning to give myself that space, to give myself the opportunity to be okay with the decisions that I was going to make and not worry about anyone else. And I think that, again, our consent is always tied to what others think, our fear that we'll be rejected. And at the end of the day, when if people love you, if people honor who you are, then consent should never be that issue. And that's something you definitely have to learn.
So you found power in permission.
Yes, there's definitely power and permission, and I know that this conversation will transition into the work that we both do, but then it goes back to my ideals and beliefs of what then becomes your convictions, right? And your convictions is what will drive who and how you give consent to anyone.
I'm Frenchie Davis. You're listening to the Consent Convo. Consent is swag, consent is smart, and smart is so sexy.
I'm Nadia Lopez. You're listening to the Consent Combo. Consent is swag. Consent is smart. And smart is definitely sexy.
Clearly, we all need much more of the C word, consent, and the F word. Not that one. This one.
from funk to Fuji La.
We used to be number 10. Now we permanent in one. In the battle, lost my finger. Mike became my uncle. I saw it's nasal. Blood becomes my warm. Tell them, oh, my be easy now. Squeeze this summer. Test why cleft. See that flesh get scorched. So bad, make me feel like you ain't wanting to be more, John. Tell your friends, stay the hell out of my lawn. Chicken George became dead George. Stealing chicken from my farm. Yeah, yeah. I let the dead pigeon. If you're my theosis, then I'm bringing all hate to Sicilian. Nobody shoot me. My body's made a hand grenade. Girl bled to death while she was tucked us in the razor blade. That sounds sick. Maybe one day I'll write the horror. Blackula comes to the ghetto. Jackson Acura. Stevie Wonder sees crack babies becoming enemies in their own families. I'ma get and come, you know what we soon done. By my side just in case I got the rum. A boy on the side of Babylon trying to front like you're down with Mount Zion.
But they can't handle us. We bust the be fortified. I could never hide. Simply hot. Ride with cold cheese. Died. I'm twisted. Back twisted by some other Negroes. Don't we move our polos on the first episode? Shouldn't just refugees and the whole sound set booty and half a respect jersey. Cause I'm super fly. When I'm super high on the Fuji line.
That was part one of the Consent Convo, a public conversation campaign on consent in partnership with Essence. You're listening to The Spin, a one-hour weekly international all-women of color podcast. I'm your host, Esther Armar.